everybody. Welcome to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. I am your co-host, Trace.
And I'm the other co-host, Julian.
And today we have a guest with us, Ashley Hamer, science communicator. I've heard that Ashley Hamer is her name and podcasting is her game, but I'll let her introduce herself.
Yes, that's correct. Podcasting is my game. I am a longtime podcaster. I used to be the host of a podcast called Curiosity Daily from Discovery. I am now a host of my own little indie podcast called Taboo Science, where I investigate all sorts of societal taboos from a scientific lens, like cannibalism and poop and race, all sorts of things.
The fun stuff.
It's all sunshine and rainbows. Yeah.
What part of the human's the best human? Have we covered that or was that not allowed?
Well, I mean, the brains are the most dangerous. I know that.
Oh, yeah.
Then you can get kuru and that's no fun.
You can get what? Anybody.
It's a kuru. It's a protein folding disease that kind of makes you go crazy and just it eats your brain.
Like
if you
human,
eat someone else's brain, your brain gets eaten.
The human equivalent of mad cow, basically, right?
Yeah.
Because it's caused by prions, right?
Or prions.
The infectious proteins that convert other proteins to the dark side and then make your brain eat itself.
And we don't really know how it works or how to fix it. It's terrifying.
Ashley, it's really exciting to have you here because you have been, I know we jokingly are like, oh, podcasting's the game, because before we started recording, like Ashley introduced, was like, I'll just say Ashley Haber's the name. And I was like, you have to include podcasting's my game after that. You just have to.
It's the rules.
But it really is your game. And it's so delightful to have you on to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. So Ashley, you know how this goes. Listeners, you probably are aware by this point, but typically what we do is we come up with an absurd or silly question, you know, can just be like while we're in the shower or walking down the street, or users submit silly questions. And then we do our best to actually dig into the research and figure out what the answer to said question would be. And since we have a guest this week, Ashley asked us a question, and why don't you tell us what it was and why you were thinking it?
Yeah, so my question was, what if babies were born with hands and feet at their adult size? And the reason I was thinking this was because, so I have a like 14-month-old, so I had a baby sort of recently. And when I was taking care of a newborn, there's a lot of just staring at the newborn that happens. Trace, I'm sure you are familiar with this.
Oh, my God. So much so. You just are like, I mean, you can't leave. So.
Right.
You just stare at it all the time.
Yeah, that's all there is to do for a while. And I noticed that, you know, all of its little body parts are so tiny, but its nostrils are the same diameter as its index finger, as its fingers.
Hmm.
And I'm like, your nostrils have always been the same diameter as your fingers your entire life. It's like size.
I'm sticking my finger in my nose. And
exactly.
You're totally right.
Yeah. And so I was like, gosh, what other parts, like what other ways are we perfectly sized for life?
Hmm.
And that is why I thought of that.
I love it.
You know, I hadn't considered the nostril finger size correlation, but it makes me feel like every time I've been shamed for picking my nose, I'm just doing what evolution dictates, right?
That's right.
You're designed for it.
Why so perfect? I'm gesturing. I'm sticking my finger up my nose as I talk to friends over the internet on video. Whoops. But it's got to be, right? Like, this is intention in case something gets clogged or in case you really need to shove a Lego piece up there.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, it's the perfect.
I mean, why are Lego pieces the same diameter? Come
on. It's just as evolution intended. The little heads on the minifigures, right?
Right.
Yeah. But you know why they put the hole in the top of that? If you look at a Lego minifigure head, there's an actual hole through the top. It's not just like a covered stud, so babies don't choke on them.
Wow.
It's exactly why.
They can still breathe through it?
Because the good people over in Denmark knew that a baby would be like, this is the right size, all the holes fit. I've been playing the shape goes where game for about 4 months now. I'm an expert. I'm gonna shove that right in my nose or throat or what have you. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So good job.
Wow. No breathing holes in the actual bricks, though. No luck there.
No, they.
Yeah, no, no.
Yeah, you're on your own. But the little heads, they yeah, expect it.
Those
yeah,
are safe. Good.
So, Julian, you answered this question to the best of your ability.
It struck me, it was so out of left field, because I was listening to Ashley pitch her question in our first meet, and it just kind of ended so abruptly. It was like, why are what if baby hands adult size? And I was like, and then? And it was just, no, so open-ended. And I was like, okay. Yeah,
bye.
I have to. Listen,
the name of the show is That's Absurd. I brought it, okay?
You were so absurd, I was not prepared. I started digging into it, and it's so open-ended. It's like, where do you want to go with it? And for me, typically, when we have an absurd question, one of the first things I want to look at is this already the case somewhere, right? And I figure, now I've never made a baby, but it seems like a complicated process where many things can go many different ways, right?
I mean, the beginning isn't that complicated. It's actually pretty
right,
easy.
Right. The your contribution the start to the baby making trace was easy.
Sure. Yeah.
And then
yes,
after that, right, it gets more complicated.
The seed funding.
Yes, as we called it.
As we call it. The seed funding.
Exactly. But like then as the you know, zygote and embryo are developing, right, it goes down. So many things have to happen. And I figured at some point, some people somewhere must be born with enlarged hands or feet. It just has to happen. So I started looking into it, and in fact, it does. And it's called macrodactyly, which just means big digits, right? Big hands or feet. It's very rare. I was looking for incident rates. I could only find data from Australia that said it happens in 0.002% of the population. I'm going to assume Australians are normal people, generally speaking. And so that's like the rate in the world as a whole. So yeah, about 0.002%, which would mean about 16 million people in the world today would have macrodactyly. At least they were born with it, right? It is usually like a unilateral condition. So like 90% of the time, it only affects one side, like one hand or one foot.
Whoa. Huh.
Yeah.
Like a fiddler crab.
Yeah, basically. Wow. Ooh, that's a great way of putting it. I wonder if it probably makes playing the fiddle really difficult, though. Especially yeah, if they're a crab. But as Ashley would know as a musician, but we'll get to that later. 70% of the time, it affects more than one digit. So most frequently, it's the index finger. And then after that, middle finger. And then the thumb is affected least frequently. So people with macrodactyly, you'll often see one hand looks like most people's hands. And then the other hand has one or two very large digits. And then like the ring finger and pinky finger are the same size as the fingers on their other hand.
Wow.
So it's very unusual looking. It often also digits get fused together or webbed, and it causes the digits to be stiff or curved. And also it can manifest in two ways. You can either have static macrodactyly, where the enlarged bones grow at the same rate over the person's life, or you can have progressive, where the bones grow faster than the other bones. And that's the one that I think is more of a concern for doctors, because as they get larger, it can really inhibit their ability to use their hand. So you might need to address it with some sort of surgery that, you know, reduces the soft tissue and maybe removes some bone. Or sometimes in cases where the finger is really growing at a rate that is hindering their ability to use their hand, just outright removing the digit might be necessary.
Dang.
Wow.
Yeah. So it does happen. But it's not like adult-sized hands or feet, usually. It's like a couple fingers, and it's usually on one hand or one foot. Your foot fingers, your toes. That's the word I'm looking for.
Your foot fingers.
Foot fingers.
Yeah.
So that's basically fingers. Okay. So I did find a guy, though, who is pretty symmetrical. His name is Jeff Dabe. He lives in Minnesota. He's 50 years old, and he has enlarged hands, both hands, and his forearms, and one enlarged foot and leg. So he's got one, and then just one leg that's, you know, average size compared to other people. This guy looks like Wreck-It Ralph.
What?
Awesome.
So I've shared his Instagram in the chat. It's just Jeff Dabe.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, Wreck-It Ralph. That is exactly what he looks like. I don't think there's a better... And then there's a picture of him actually dressed as Wreck-It Ralph.
Yes.
Because he's... Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's great.
Or he's... Oh, my God!
He says
lean into it, man.
People also describe him as, like, real-life Popeye. Right? Just those huge forearms. You should get some anchor tattoos on those.
How heavy are his arms?
Probably pretty heavy. Now,
yeah.
Here's the best part. Ashley, read his bio in his Instagram that says what his profession is.
Oh, no.
Oh,
this
my.
Is a spot to take a look at Minnesota professional arm wrestler doing all kinds of stuff.
He's
that is unfair.
Professional oh, arm wrestler.
God, that's so good.
Isn't it? Right.
I'm going to wreck it.
So
he has found his niche for sure.
Fantastic, right? He's oh, it's unfair, but I'm like, you know, people are born and grow up to be like 6'12" and play basketball. Like,
that's true.
I don't see how that's any different. You know, he's just got a natural athletic predisposition to basically breaking forearms.
Yeah.
And so I found like videos of him going to arm wrestling competitions, and he's like talking about how other guys will avoid him. He's like doing circuits around the Midwest. And like he's like, this guy, he won't come to Minnesota, so I came over here to Montana because he's avoiding me. And then he just demolishes everybody. And he's talking about like, yeah, they all work out really hard and I don't. But he says he was just born this way. And they've done tests, he says, and they have no idea why he's like this. It's just natural. But that's true for macrodactyly in general, is we don't understand why people are born with these enlarged digits. There's not a genetic component as far as we can tell. It's not inherited. It seems to involve something that happens during development, you know, prenatally, but otherwise the causes are still being investigated. But it's so rare, I think that there also probably hasn't been a lot of attention paid to the condition. So given that...
Holy crap, boy. Wait.
Yeah.
I Googled him, and one of the top results is his wedding ring is 4.78 inches around.
Yeah, yeah.
The diameter of his finger?
Yeah.
Is 4 inches?
No. Around, that would be circumference. So divide that by pi, right? So it's like an inch and change, right?
Wow.
Still large. Still a large, large finger. Actually, a video I found of him going to arm wrestling competitions, his wife is in the background losing her mind every time. And I'm like... Goals, like,
you know, I was
great.
Getting really sad with all the talk about people like not losing the ability to use their hands, but then this has turned it back around. I'm happy
again.
Yeah.
Jeff Dabe's really made the most of it.
Yeah.
So to answer the question though of what if we were all Jeff Dabes, just like a bunch of Wreck-It Ralphs and Ralphinas running around. First of all, arm wrestling, I think, would be the national sport. Like, that would probably be how civilization settled conflicts as a whole, I assume. But my first thought, actually, was the impact it would have on complicating child. That's immediately, like, my concern is, okay, if you've got enormous adult-sized hands and feet on a little bitty baby, like, how is that going to affect parents as they're giving birth? So... I looked into it and, you know, infant mortality, this is going to be the downer part of the episode. Sorry, everybody. But not infant mortality. Maternal mortality, right, like in underdeveloped countries is about 430 deaths per 100,000 live births. So for every 100,000 births, about 430 birth givers die. So it's better in developed countries, typically, right? That's the average is 12 per 100,000. By the way, the U.S. is the worst in terms of developed country with maternal mortality.
It's I was about very 27. Aware of that while I was pregnant.
Yeah. In Sweden, it's like 9. In the U.K., it's 12. And then here in the U.S., it's like 26, 27.
Yep.
Cool.
And it's getting
good
worse.
Job, America.
Yay.
And it's yeah. We're not living as long and we're dying from routine medical procedures. It's
Hooray.
Great
yes.
to live here.
Freedom.
Anyway, so I'm gonna steer this away from the downer part of the episode now. I'm glad we had that little detour. And I'm gonna observe just like what that would probably mean from an evolutionary standpoint for the human race, right? Because there would be a point before medicine whatsoever, right? Like now, okay, infant mortality because of medicine. medicine, we can address it. But before medicine existed, right, you just, people just had to raw dog birth, right? Just go for it.
Raw and, dog birth.
And hope for the best.
Honestly, good, really good album name.
for the band, you know? Attack Balloons. Yeah, still Attack my Balloons. Favorite band name that we came up with long ago. Yeah.
Attack Balloons. And this is a single off our third album, Raw Dog Birth.
So before medicine, right, I assume that maternal mortality would be closer, probably much higher still than what it was in underdeveloped nations, right? And so the leading cause of those deaths too is hemorrhaging, where, you know, you get something tearing, something breaking, a lot of bleeding, and eventually the birth giver passes away. So I assume if the hands and feet were giant, that would occur more frequently.
Yeah, you're not gonna have a good time.
Like, no. Like the average baby length is like 50 centimeters, right? And the average adult foot size is about half that, like 24 to 27 centimeters, right? And then you got to think it's like in a like the baby's long ways, but then the foot is like upward, like a different axis, right? So yeah, it would be bad. But I think, and I'm speculating with no way of knowing this because you can't, but I think this would affect the point in development when babies are born.
Oh, yeah.
So human beings, right, have large brains, and we walk upright, right? These are two of our defining characteristics. But you'll notice, as recent parents, that we also, our babies take a long time to learn how to walk, right? It's typically around 10 to as late as 18 months. Whereas, you know, an antelope is born, and then it's up and running away from a cheetah, like, within minutes, sort of thing. And the reason for this, according to researchers, is our brains are less developed when we're born. They're not as far along in the development cycle because in order to fit through that narrow birth canal that our upright walking necessitates, our brains need to be smaller. So I hypothesize that if our hands and feet were enormous for no discernible reason, that we would trend toward having earlier births in because mothers who did that would survive more frequently.
Yeah.
Or
larger
pelvic openings.
Ooh, big old hips. That's
which
another
then
idea.
Maybe they would. Maybe it could be the opposite, right? We would be in the birthing longer, but the pelvis wouldn't, because they say, you know, the pelvis is a compromise, right?
Well, so then women
it's
would
an
be
evolutionary
able to walk.
Compromise.
That's a compromise,
right?
Yeah.
Or we'd all look like Pixar moms, right? Just those wide,
really
wide
in the bottom,
right? And then Popeye arms and legs. So we would be a hybrid of Wreck-It Ralph.
Oh my god!
Pixar mom.
Now, if you had this is like a chain reaction. Right. If you had bigger hips to have babies with bigger hands and feet and you couldn't walk upright, then we'd all be on our hands and feet, which were bigger anyway. And then that would make for just better survival.
True.
I think we just invented the gorilla.
I
think what we did is come up with gorillas, guys.
We nailed it.
Good job.
Okay, baby.
That could have been. I didn't think of this.
See, I was picturing the people from WALL-E.
They're
like all kind of egg-shaped, you know.
Oh, man.
Oh, wow.
I didn't think of gorillas. Okay. Dang it.
No one ever expects gorillas.
Okay, well, let's assume, though, that our brains develop still like normal and we develop all the things that make us human and, you know, intelligent and whatnot. I think this would mean we aren't walking until later in life, like closer to 2 years and beyond. And we aren't as mature until later in life. So instead of like an 18-year-old being considered an adult, you know, in modern society, it would be like a 20-year-old, right? I think the drinking age then goes up as a result and voting age. So society looks different. But here was, I think, the most important takeaway is in the videos I found of Jeff Dabe talking about his day-to-day life, he mentions he has to use a flip phone because he can't
use
an iPhone. It's too small, right?
It's too little.
Because his hands are so big.
It's too wee.
So I think either Gorilla Steve Jobs invents the iPad straight away, And then the iPad is the size of your TV. Or we never come up with smartphones, and therefore I think society as a whole is better for reasons that I'm biased about, but also podcasting doesn't take off and we aren't all sitting here having this conversation.
Imagine the size of the iPod with those just big old buttons.
When you gotta, remember when it was the wheel on the iPod? Yeah. You had to scroll. It would be like a turning a wheel on a big Spanish kind of galleon.
Wouldn't be very portable, but man, it would be cool.
No. Well, the pockets on your giant jeans, because of your big old dump truck booty, would be able to fit it, though.
That's true.
Right?
Everybody would just wear coveralls.
Yeah.
Just be, everybody's in overalls.
Everyone's
all the time.
Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it makes sense.
See, as the furthest I got when I was trying to think through this, because I didn't want to think too far, because I wanted to be surprised, but was babies would be amazing swimmers, and maybe they would be hopping around like kangaroos. That was as far as I got.
So if it's just the hands or feet, right, I looked into it, and another reason that we don't walk for as long is because of we have a lot of cartilage in our joints when we're newborns and babies, right? And the cartilage can't support our body weight and stuff. But I also think it would not be able to support the weight of our big old hands and feet as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think we would take longer to walk as a result of that as well. So, I think we'd be much worse jumpers. I think we'd be like feeble, little, like massive hands. So if things came near us, you could like slap it, but you couldn't hop away like a kangaroo.
Man, be that's careful my,
that's
what
my
you wish for.
Theory.
Okay.
I mean, that's so weird. I'm thinking like, how much does your foot weigh?
Yeah.
Like an adult foot, because if you had two of those, oh God, there's a whole website.
Well, the
about
other
this.
Thing is, like, baby feet are just big sausages.
Gross.
They're not like, they don't look like flat feet.
I think Trace just discovered Wiki Feet.
Oh no!
Ugh.
When he's like,
no.
There's a whole website about feet weight. I'm like, no, Trace, don't go there.
Don't go
to Wiki Feet.
Oh, I know Wiki Feet, not for the reason that you might be thinking.
You're on it. You have a whole entry.
I wish I was on it. No one wants to post pictures.
I'll
of
make
feet.
Your Wiki Feet page,
thanks,
Trace.
Man. It's all people I used to work with.
Oh.
The average foot size is 9.5 in the U.S., and that weighs approximately 2.3 pounds. So if a baby's born and is 6 or 7 pounds.
Jeez, that's a lot.
Normally now, they have an extra 5 of feet.
And that's not counting
that's
hands.
About a kilogram,
they're double,
by the
they're
way.
Double their weight. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
30% feet.
I would. Oh, no. That sounds awful. That sounds
this
awful.
This is a bad idea,
levels.
I'm guessing. So I'm not. Yeah. No. So if a genie comes to me and asks me for wishes, I'm not going to wish for this.
This was going to be your first wish before that, though.
I don't know.
You're like, I want giant baby hands and feet.
What if I just like.
I'm sick of waiting for their.
What if I'm just like under pressure and I can't think of anything? Like, this is going to be the thing.
Adult feet, adult hands. Your wish is my command. And every
weird,
every
okay.
birthing every birthing human in the world goes, Ashley.
Well,
wow, that was absurd.
Yeah, thank you
I loved
for
it.
Your truly absurd question. That was fun.
Appreciate
you're welcome.
It.
Let's take a quick break and we'll come back with another question. And we're back. Okay. Whew, I'm still reacting to we invented gorillas. That was pretty good. Okay. So up next, we have another question. And this one is actually submitted by a listener.
Hi there. I'm David from London. And I have a question for you. When learning the piano, I've never got past what we would call grade 2 in the UK. A bit better than playing chopsticks, but still very much a beginner. Now, one thing that really infuriates me is the way that notes are written on the page. In particular, the key signature that shows you which notes have to be played using the black keys all the time. Sometimes the key signature seems to have 4, 5, 6 sharps or flats, which is a lot to remember. So my question is, why can't everything be written in C major? That's the key that doesn't require you to remember anything. Would you affect how the song sounds if you always used C major? I get that sometimes you have to vary the pitch to suit somebody's voice or vocal range, but is there a way of always choosing a key signature that, say, only has three sharps in it? If you can transpose songs to a different key signature that's easier to play, why don't they always do that? Thanks for listening. I look forward to hearing your answers.
Yeah.
So that is from David B. This is complicated. This is a complicated question. I play music. I do not read music.
Yeah.
If you tell me to play an A, I'm like, huh? But if you tell me to play a song on a fife, I will play you that song.
Trace is always looking for an excuse to get the fife out on this podcast.
I have heard your fifing on this podcast.
Yeah. It's just fantastic. The instrument closest to me. It just sits in the
Trace
drawer.
Is his name and fifing is his game.
That's right.
Yeah. Man loves to fife. Well, David, you are in luck because, as it turns out, I can't think of a more qualified person to actually answer this question. Ashley, you're, along with being a science communicator, you're a trained musician,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I have a master's degree in music. I played jazz saxophone, and I've taken a lot of music theory classes, and I can answer this question for sure.
That's so great. I'm excited. Tell me everything about this.
Yes. So I'll start out with the boring stuff. David is absolutely right. A big reason is like vocal range, and not just voices, but all instruments. Piano is not, you know, the be all end all. There are a lot of instruments out there that have a lot of different needs. Like for me, I play saxophone. Saxophone is actually pitched differently than piano. So when you're playing in C, David, I'm playing in D major. So I have two sharps. Mm. So that's a little bit more difficult, right? The other thing is, I think maybe an instrument that a lot of the listeners probably are familiar with is guitar. Do either of you guys play any guitar?
Yes.
I tried to play guitar.
I do.
I couldn't get it.
What's the first?
I wanted to date in college, I picked up guitar.
Good,
it didn't work. It did not
but
have
what is,
the desired
what's
effect.
The first chord you learned?
What's the first chord of Wonderwall?
Okay.
I want to say.
Wow,
I think we can.
I think we can figure out why you didn't get a lot of dates. He's just
look,
walking
today
around.
Was going to be the day that they were going to throw it back to me.
Julia just shows up at parties and goes, baby. And everybody's like, leave.
Yeah,
leave.
Let everybody go.
No, we've all been there.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But no, you actually said it. E? Was it?
I think it's E major 7.
Yeah. So guitar is easiest to play in E, which is a really difficult key for a piano. That's a lot of sharps. So so that's one reason, is just that, you know, piano has to play nice with all the other instruments, and not all instruments have the same needs, and some keys are easier for some instruments to play than others.
I have a question. What is an E?
What do you mean, what is an E?
I don't know what that is.
Well,
I don't understand.
So that's just the thing about music, from what I understand, is the notes are just like set frequencies that we've agreed
right.
on.
Yes.
Like this frequency and the harmonic multiples above it are all, you know, E. Or right, and it's different depending on culture, right? Because like Western music has the 12 half step scale to until you start repeating frequencies. Right.
Right. Yes. So I'm going to get into all of that because it's so mathy.
Oh my God. Yeah.
So
okay.
Sciencey,
great.
But
I
no,
do
we can
love
start.
The
we can start. Let's
music.
Do it. So sound is on a spectrum, just like color. You can think of it like color. And we have red, green, blue. We have A, C, E. We have all of that. What we do is we look at this spectrum and we decide how to divide it up. Now, color, we divide it up into like tons and tons and tons of different chunks. You know, you got your hot pink, you got your mauve, you got whatever. But it's like, for Western music, we have divided it up into 12 pieces. And there are a lot of historical reasons for that. We could have divided it into 10 chunks. We could have divided it into 72 chunks. And technically, there are a lot of instruments that don't have to divide them into chunks at all, like the violin. There are no frets on a violin. You can just, you know, the whole thing.
Like a trombone.
Yeah, trombone.
I played the trombone for years and years.
Oh, nice.
Still didn't know what an E is.
I can completely picture Trace playing a trombone.
Yeah,
I was like, See, I thought when I went to fifth grade and they're like, okay, cool, you can go to this room if you want to be in the band. You can try all the instruments, and they like cleaned them in between each student, and you'd be like, pick an instrument and you can try it. And so I tried a few and I was like, this one doesn't have any buttons on it. I like that. I'm going to go with
yeah,
this
one.
I
had the opposite.
I had the opposite logic. I was like, three buttons on a trumpet? Heck yeah.
You are. Of course you're a trumpeter.
Sign me up. Yeah. Well, I really was liked ska music in middle school because I had a lot of suburban preteen angst.
No, that's
and
perfect.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to play saxophone. Too many people were playing saxophone. So, like, you start on clarinet. If you keep up with this, then you can switch to saxophone. And actually, that was really good advice because clarinet's way harder than saxophone. And so you're better at saxophone when you start. But
nice. Yeah. Take that, saxophonists.
Man, saxophone is newer than the bicycle. It is like a very modern machine.
I didn't know that. Yeah, when did it get invented?
In the 1800s sometime. I can't remember. Like 1850-ish. Don't quote me
on
that.
By a guy whose name I assume was Sax, wasn't it?
It was. Did you know that or did you just guess that? Yeah.
No, because I thought, well, sousaphone, right, is like John Philip Sousa. So it's
also humans are bad at names.
Yeah, we really are.
Like, we're just bad. It's just like, huh, we came from England. We're not in England. Where are we going to be? New England.
It's true.
Done. So, we've done it.
Yeah, and right, phone just means sound. So like if Trace, you invented an instrument, it would be the Traceaphone.
I don't know. I'd try and come up with a cooler name than that.
The Domingle Jingler.
Honestly, that's better.
That's a good
the
Domingue like
Jingle.
Domingue Jingle. I play the Domingue Jingle. Yeah, I thought about that. Like, how often are instruments invented? The last one I can think of would probably be the theremin.
Yeah.
In like... because it's like so electric, unless you count like electric guitars, but that I think that's just a
computer
development.
Exactly.
You know?
They're like new versions of existing instruments.
Yeah, Trace, that's a good point. Things like keyboards that can play like sample and MIDI stuff.
Anything they want.
Yeah. Keytars, that's got to be the most recent.
Yeah,
the
but key-tar. Actually, it's really interesting that you say that because all of those, you know, keytars and keyboards and synthesizers are all based on this older instrument, the piano. And that's basically what we have based all Western music on since we invented it. And so everything that went into inventing the piano has now stuck with music, and this is how we do things forever. But there were a ton of instruments that existed before the piano, and the piano had to get along with those instruments. And so this division of 12 notes was kind of a compromise to make it so they could most closely approximate the intervals and notes and stuff that these other instruments had played. But before the piano, get ready. Hope you're sitting down. There were more than 12 notes before the piano. And So like they're because they divided tones into more than 12 chunks. For example, so one thing that you learn when you're like starting out is enharmonics. So something like B flat, that's the same as A sharp, right? Mm-hmm. So there are all sorts of different C sharp, same as D flat, E flat, same as D sharp, things like that. That was actually not true before the piano was invented. Those were slightly different notes, and that's why we have different names for them.
Thank you for answering that, because that has driven me crazy forever.
Good. Yeah. Actually, this was the first time I learned this, too, actually.
I thought it only existed so a cappella groups in colleges could have dumb pun names like the B sharps or something, which is C.
That
anyway.
I mean, that is very handy, though.
I do love a pun. I'm not actually mad at those a cappella groups. I take it back. But you know what I mean. Like, it's why would we have redundant naming conventions that just seem to add confusion.
Yeah, and that's why. It's like history, man. And so
that's so cool.
Yeah. And so there are the way that we currently divide up these 12 notes is evenly. We take the octave and we just divide it exactly evenly so that every single note is the same distance apart from every other note around it. But that was also not always the case. So this is where we get into like the physics of it. the original way to tune the scale was the Pythagorean tuning, which is basically like if you take a guitar string and you divide it in half, you get an octave. You get like the guitar string before you divide it, it's C. You divide it in half and it is the C above it. So like a higher C. If you divide it into three halves, like a 3-to-2 ratio, you get a fifth. So that would be G. Yeah, I'm going to try not to get like too technical about it. But so there are all these different ratios that you can do to get these different notes. And these ratios sound really good. Like they work with the overtone series. They work with like the physics of sound, and they sound really pure. So Pythagorean tuning, what that is you take you basically take that guitar string, you divide it into three halves, then you divide in three halves again and again and again and again until you get 12 notes. Then you kind of arrange them all to the right octaves, and then you have a scale. That sounds totally different than the scale that we currently have. But the problem is that it doesn't sound good. Like, that scale sounds super weird, and it doesn't sound in tune when you play chords with it. So people were like, okay, well, maybe we don't have to have all of them be like these perfect fifths. Maybe we'll do other ratios. So there's this just tuning system that uses whole number ratios that are a little bit, you know, they just adjust it a little bit. That one sounds a little better, but it's also not what we have today. But if you listen to versions of just tuning compared to our current tuning system, which is called equal temperament, actually sounds way better because it's based on tuning these perfect intervals. Do I still have you guys? I don't want to get too...
I think so.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. So let me try this. So Pythagorean tuning, I don't want to explain it because I don't understand it, but it doesn't sound right because the notes aren't spaced the same way as they are in our modern tuning. So our modern tuning, we went from 0 to 100 and we said, okay, at every 12 or whatever, every 12th of that is a note. Whereas the Pythagorean tuning seems like it would curve if you graphed
it. Like exactly,
It wouldn't be just like an even. It would be almost like a function of something. And so it doesn't, the notes, two notes that you play separate from each other aren't going to sound right to our ears.
Right.
It's not that they're not right. It's just we're not used to
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And yeah, you get higher and higher, exactly that curve. Like once you get higher and higher in the scale, it starts to sound weirder and weirder because they're not really, those intervals don't care about the notes that are next to it, to them. They just care about their relationship to the bottom note. So that's weird. There's really no like perfect way to tune music is what I'm saying. But the thing is with a lot of these tuning systems, different keys sounded different because you had to actually like retune an instrument to be in a different key. And you didn't always do that. So sometimes if you were playing a Glockenspiel with another instrument and they were in a certain key, you're just going to play in that key. You're not going to retune. And so you're playing in these different keys, and these different keys have different moods. They have actually different sounds because the notes are actually different versus today.
I had heard that, and it struck me as like music astrology, you know?
Today it is. Like, it feels that way.
Okay.
Because in equal temperament, they're really not different. The spaces between all of the notes are going to be the same whether you're in C sharp major or F major. It's all going to just be... transposed to a different height on the scale, but it's not all of the relationships are the same, but the relationships weren't always the same.
That makes a lot more sense. Yeah, because I understand that at least of like, oh, if you're transposing as with music as we know it today, really you're just shifting the whole thing, you know, up or down.
Yes.
Like
up
when
or down.
It's very evident when you play guitar, right? Because literally if you just like put a clamp on the neck, a capo or a capo, as they would say in England, and I know we have a British listener to this one, then you play all the same shapes and you're in presto changeo, a different key, right? But your fingers are still doing the things that they would do, you know, lower down on the neck, and it doesn't really, it doesn't affect the relationship the notes have.
Yes.
Right? It really just makes it easier
the relationship,
to sing it.
The relationship to each other is the same. You're just moving around where you're, interesting.
Also, one of my favorite facts about England is they call eighth notes quavers and 16th notes hemiquavers and demiquavers and semiquavers. They get really weird. I love it.
Those sounds like conditions like right before you're about to give birth. Oh my God, the quavers are, the quavers are an eighth note apart.
I was thinking more like, I've got the quavers. And it's like, oh.
Exactly.
Where's my fainting couch?
Rush them to the government-funded hospital immediately. Forthwith.
Okay, so to get back to David's question then, why isn't everything in C major then?
Yeah, so because art is complicated and there is a lot of history here. So in all of the time that music has been written, especially like Western music and the kinds of music that David's probably playing, you know, that's he could be playing a piece from 10 years ago. He could be playing a piece from 400 years ago. And those all of those pieces had different contexts in which they were written. They had different instruments that they were playing with. They had different tunings that they were written with. And so those are reasons that different pieces of music would be in different keys, just because of those needs of the composer at the time. And but really, from a modern standpoint, if you really think about it, like you could think about it like art. Right. Why isn't everything just in black and white? It would be simpler. Or like, why don't we just paint with like blue and red? Like it gives us a wider palette. If you are a musician who does this a lot, you do start to hear certain keys. And like I know in every band I've played with where we play like a wedding or a concert at like a bar, you never want to play the same key twice. You want to split it up because that sounds boring. Like you want the music to be constantly changing. And so it just gives you a wider palette to pick from. And it also just makes it easier to play with certain instruments. And then there's also just all of this historical context that goes into it. Yeah.
Wow. That's so cool. It sounds to me like what our listener really needs is a capo for his piano, where you just open up the lid and you put like a giant clamp down on the string at a certain length and like, bam, you're in a new key. And
that'd
you don't
be
have
awesome.
To worry
I mean,
about like.
Pretty sure you could do that with keyboards, just like with a button. So you don't even need the giant.
That's probably
but
true.
I mean, that's not as cartoonish. So I like your idea better.
My brain only works in impractical cartoon solutions.
That's true, actually.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's part of why we started the show.
Wow. Okay. Wait, I still have another question,
yeah.
though. What's an E?
All right.
Trace, I looked it up. I have the frequency
oh.
here.
Oh, good.
If you want to know. The frequency yeah. of middle E is approximately 329.628 hertz.
Oh, great.
So that's
okay,
an
thanks.
E.
Perfect.
That's
answered my question.
Yep.
Cycles per second. Hertz is cycles per second, right? So the air vibrates back and forth 329.628 times every second. And when it does, you hear middle E.
E is probably the first note of most rock songs, I'm going to say.
Because of,
it's the
like
bottom string of guitar and the bass, and yeah. Mm-hmm. I bet if you put on any rock song right now, the first note would be E. That's my guess.
Yeah.
Would be E.
Yeah. And then, Trace, when I said earlier, oh, it's an E major 7th or whatever, chords are named for the different notes that they're comprised of, right? Like, the name of the chord is the tonic note, the lowest note. Right. And then it's usually like a major chord is like a major third interval. So if you go like two notes up,
I don't know.
Right. So
no, it's easy. It's easy. So it's just that the scale is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So a major
yeah,
third is
it.
1, 3. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So it would be like C would be if you're playing a C chord, C would be your tonic. And then D, E would be your third, your major third. And then you go up two more notes. So have G. would be your fifth, and then you have a major chord.
Yeah.
And that sounds bright and happy, and then if you want to make a minor chord, you lower the third from a major third to a minor third. So you go from E to E flat, and then you're playing a minor C.
And it sounds sad.
I still don't get it.
Yeah.
Put a trombone in my hand, and you all play, I will play with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I guess you
whatever
can't play
you're playing,
chords on a trombone.
Whatever you are playing, I will play it. It's fine. I'm not going to, you know, brush off my shoulder, but I've won some awards from a jazz.
Wow.
When
nice.
I was in high school.
Hey.
But if the band director was ever like, play an A, everyone, I would wait for everyone to play and then play that A with them.
With the trombone, though, you can just slowly slide into.
Yeah. I swear to God, I played trombone for 8 years. I was a musician at my job at the museum and played the fife and the bugle and all of these, and I would read the music and I knew what it was supposed to what I was supposed to play, and I could sight read. I cannot tell you what an A is. Don't know.
Wait, you can read. I don't understand. You can read music, but you don't know what an A is. What is that? What do you mean?
Yep. I just know what it's. I know the instrument that I'm playing. Once I know how to use the instrument, I can make it play that whatever I'm looking at.
So you can see, you know, like which note on the staff corresponds with which key on the instrument, but you don't know like right. what
whatever
the name
the
of that key that note is.
It's like mastering a video game and not knowing what the moves are called.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I can play Street Fighter. I don't have to know what move I'm. You know, like oh, well, that's his forward right punch. I'm just like, nope, don't need to do that. I can do that.
I can just make the character do the thing.
You did the hard part.
Yeah, exactly. You did the hard part. The easy part is just. I mean, like. Face is the spaces, F-A-C-E, and then the lines are every good boy does fine. So now you got it.
Yeah. With treble clef, right?
With treble clef, yeah, bass clef, whatever.
Well, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're playing trombone. Dang it.
Yeah.
Sorry, I made everything hard.
Yeah, but like I can't sight read. I come from a musical theater background, like as a stage actor, which means, spoiler alert, none of us know how to sight read. We all just buy the Broadway original cast soundtrack and then mimic it. I have a friend who's a professionally trained opera singer, and she was peeved when she went to an audition for a musical theater role, and everybody sang like the soundtrack, the Broadway soundtrack, and she sight read, and it was different, and the director was like, can you do it more like what everybody else did? And she was like, I'm reading the notes, goddammit. Like,
that's amazing. Art is complicated.
It is.
Fascinating, though. Thank you for addressing, though, that, like, in fact, the keys don't really have different moods today, but that they did at some point.
They did, and everybody knew what they were. Like, I read something like, A flat major was the key of the grave. Like, that was it. And now, and you heard it, and you're like, oh, yeah, that's death. But like today, I wouldn't be able to tell you which songs were in A flat major. I can't hear that. But people could at the time because they had a specific quality.
I wonder how hard it would be to book like an old timey music band for my funeral that will play in A flat major.
Oh, man, if you went to a university, like their historical instrument department, they'd be like, oh, my God, yes, I never get a gig.
We'd love to play your funeral.
Look, just call a reenactment group.
I can't wait for your death.
I'm telling you, I didn't learn the fife in a vacuum here. There are people who this is all they do is historical instruments.
Well, you wouldn't be able to play a wind instrument. Well, any instrument in a vacuum, right?
Okie dokie.
All right, let's take another break. And when we come back, we'll have Trace's question. And we're back. We've gone through my question on what if, well, Ashley's question technically on what if babies were born with giant hands and feet. We had a listener question Ashley addressed on what's up with all the different key signatures in music. And finally, Trace, it is time for your question.
That's right. And my question actually comes from Julian. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, so I'll just say H.
Hug it.
Julian H. Hug it out.
Okay.
So please tell me what your question was and how you thought.
All right. Picture this. You're in a grocery store. You're walking down the aisle, right? You're in the baking needs section and you go buy the marshmallows, right? What do you do when you pass the marshmallows? You grab the bag, right? You put it to your face and then you take a deep, deep breath, right? You just inhale that marshmallow through the bag. So I was doing this. And
just hanging out,
yeah, you know, avoiding security again. And I'm breathing in. I'm inhaling these marshmallows and a thought occurs to me. And that is the marshmallows are in the bag, but the smell is coming through the bag. The smell's got to be made of marshmallow bits, right? Like it has to be a piece of the marshmallow. A tiny microscopic piece that's coming through the bag into my nose. So I thought, given enough time, if these marshmallows just sat here and like I huffed away, would I disintegrate these marshmallows into nothing? Or at some point would they lose all, like what happens? Can something disintegrate via smell? That is the essence of the question. And Trace, you decided it, you jumped at this one, so.
Yeah, so I think smell is fascinating. I think people know how it works and they're like, oh, it's connected to memory and all of these things, which is all true. I mean, we'll get into it in a second. I want to just throw out here in the very first few seconds, yes. The answer is yes. Something can disappear from being smelly.
What?
Wow.
It is true. It can happen. But when you're thinking of describing this really odd behavior that I don't recommend of grabbing marshmallow bags and smelling them, not only because...
Huff and the puff, as we call it in my house.
Someone's going to take that bag home and it's just going to have Julian on it.
My face. Like a memory foam pillow.
But also, you know, you're not really supposed to put plastic over your face and inhale.
Yeah,
like, that's not.
Yeah,
I've seen movies
that
and that doesn't work. But yeah, you are 100% right. Smell is made up of physical little particles, and those little particles go into your face and you are able to sense what it is that they have come from. It's an incredible sense that we don't think about as often, I think, as we should. So the short answer is yes. That is exactly what happens when you smell something. It's little pieces, and it does slowly disappear. But, you know, really, really slowly for most things. So quick refresher on smell. You have these olfactory sensory neurons inside of your sinuses. They're at the back of your nose. They're actually more back than they are up. Like, we like to, because of the shape of our nose, we like to think our nose goes up, but it actually goes more backward, kind of into our skull.
I know this because my husband can hammer nails up his nose, and the way that you do that is not by going up, you go back. Back is the way you want. Up is brain.
Why?
Back is
why is
correct.
He doing the nose? Why is meant for fingers, as we know.
I know.
Not nails.
Aye.
He's why? A weird dude. He's been doing this since he was like a baby. He's a sideshow person.
Okay, got it. Well, we won't dig into that.
Legos went straight to nails.
Exactly.
That's smarter though, because the nails got the head. You can get a hammer and just yank it out, not like a Lego.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Always want that flared base.
So in the back of your nose, before the nail gets there, I would hope, there is what we call, just generally, people are like, the olfactory bulb, which I picture like, you know, like the surface of a balloon, but it's not like that. And on it are neurons, and each neuron has a receptor, or on it are receptors, and each receptor has a neuron, really, because it's connected more or less directly to your brain. And so what happens is a molecule will float into your sinuses on the air that you are breathing, and it will hit a receptor on the olfactory bulb. And when it hits it, it literally like docks with it. It like makes a little connection, and an ion channel is formed. When that ion channel is opened, which essentially like charged particles flow back and forth over membranes, it's how humans are alive, it tells the brain what molecule it is. And doing that is we interpret it as smell. I said a molecule, but it actually has to be lots of molecules, which we didn't know until recently. I thought really interesting. So in 2005, a study came out that was titled, like, basically, the nose doesn't work like eyes.
This just in, nose not eyes.
Yeah.
Grant money, please.
Wait, are all scientists just Henry Winkler's children from...
Money, please.
Money, please.
They kind of are on some level. Because it turns out we study the eye a lot. So there's this thing called the G protein. It's complicated. I'm not going to get into it. But basically, when a single photon hits a rod or a cone in your eye, it can activate a protein channel, a protein in your eyeball that's released, and it amplifies that photon signal so that you can experience it. Even if it's just one photon, your brain is like, whoop, something hit something. But that's not the case with your nose. You need more molecules. And so the closer you get to something smelly, there's just more and more stuff in the air, so you're smelling more of it. But at some point, you back away from it and you can't smell it at all, even though the stuff is still there. So we have 400 different olfactory receptors, and we're capable of detecting about a trillion different smells, they think, which makes it actually more sensitive than the eye, but it doesn't work. Like, it has a lower limit where it's like, well, we're just not going to, we can't, we're not going to amplify that signal at all. So it's really interesting how kind of smell works. But the takeaway is you need a physical bit of whatever you're smelling, and more than one piece of it, in order to activate an olfactory receptor. It's not magic. It's just little physical particles.
And the different shapes of whatever you're smelling, right, like activate different olfactory sensors, right? And so like the combination is how you distinguish unique smells, right?
Right.
The way
right.
I remember it is from Magic School Bus. There's like and I don't think this is actually the way, obviously it's not the way it works, but they had like basically puzzle pieces that were just like going into different little shapes in the nose.
I mean, that's not that unusual. I mean, organic chemistry is complicated, so I think that's a pretty good explanation of how these little
mental level
things
though,
work.
It is all like everything protein related. It's mostly like puzzle pieces, you know, like complex. Yeah. Just, but it's all like shape related. Like like key goes into correct lock and then like activates stuff. Typically, right? So yeah, that makes sense.
Right.
To me.
Nice.
And so that's how things can be in the air and have no smell to us, right? Some particle can be in the air, but we don't have a way to smell it, so it's considered odorless. That's assuming, of course, it gives off anything. You know, like CO2, for example. We don't have receptors that can pick up CO2, so that's why you don't smell CO2 in the air, because it doesn't have an odor. We don't have a receptor that can lock into that, a little puzzle piece, if you will, that can connect to it that allows us to smell it. So when Julian is putting his face into a marshmallow bag, he's likely smelling, you know, little what's called volatile compounds, things that are coming off of the marshmallow and into the air. It's more interesting, I think, on some level, like little sidebar, that it's going through the plastic, and that's because there's different types of plastic, and the plastic is porous enough that those little compounds can get in and out. Essentially, air can move in and out of that bag.
This reminds me of like the thing with COVID masks, and people were like, well, you can smell a fart. Like, how is it going to keep you from getting the virus? And the reason is that viruses are much larger than the individual little molecules that are coming through from the fart.
Molecules are tiny.
Humans aren't really good at things at very small scale or very large scale, right? Yeah, at a certain point, you're like, oh, it's the same. And you're like, no, this thing is hundreds of times bigger than like a single molecule, because it's made of many molecules. So
you're saying like, how can that car get through that tunnel, but I can't breathe a building through it, you idiot.
Exactly. It's like cars made of metal and stuff like put together. You're like, no,
they're made of the
like,
same thing.
The scale is different.
It's really tough. So the key of this is volatile compounds. So you have volatile compounds in things like marshmallows, but I want to try something really quick. We're going to need to go and find some music for this, but I think it's going to be good. You guys ready to try this?
Sure.
Okay. Welcome to our new game show, Smell or No Smell. Also, that's not a good name. Help me come up with it. Here's the other one I wrote down. Odor or Noder.
I like it. Yazel or Nasal.
The marvelous Mrs. Nasal.
I knew you guys would come through on this.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a thing, and you tell me if it has a smell, and if it does, what that smell is.
I'm not looking forward to this. I was a guest on Ashley's podcast once, and I got quizzed, and I missed every single question, and it haunts me to this day.
Aww.
So I'm not looking forward to it.
Okay, we'll go with Ashley first.
Yay.
A really common one. Can you describe the smell of, like, pennies or, like, coins?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's, like, metallic. There's a copper smell. I don't know.
Would you say a penny has a smell?
Yes.
Okay, so it doesn't. Metal does not give off any volatile compounds. In fact, no metal has any smell whatsoever because it's a solid thing that doesn't like flake off and give particles to your receptors. So what you smell when you smell pennies is actually oil and oxidation of skin lipids from the people who have touched that penny, including yourself.
Oh no! So that's what I'm tasting too.
Oh no, Julian! So it's aldehydes and ketones. There's no metal in that smell at all because metal doesn't create volatile compounds.
Wow!
It doesn't have those. And so, a bonus question for you, Ashley: does blood have a smell?
Oh.
This is surprisingly hard.
It is.
Right?
I'm going to say yes again. I mean, it's like meat.
It's the same.
Really?
It's the same thing. It's the iron in the blood reacts with the fat on our skin. And then the fat on our skin does like flake off and we smell that. So when we smell blood, it's actually, and metal in general, it's a thing called a 1-octan-3-1, which is CH2 double bonded with a CHC double bonded with O, CH2-4-CH3.
Got it.
So it's just like this specific molecule that we associate as like we evolved to associate with metallic things, likely because we should probably be able to smell blood.
Oh, wow.
But it's not really the blood or the metal. So like rusty metal doesn't have, it's not actually a smell, but you can think of it, right? Like you smell, you're at a rusty metal, like by the train tracks or whatever, and the train just went by, and you can probably smell the diesel and things in the air because those are burned, but you don't actually smell the metal even though you associate something with it.
Wow.
Okay, Julian.
Yes.
Describe the smell of bacteria.
Oh, man. Well, okay, how tricky are we going to get? Is this going to be like, it's actually a product of the bacteria you're smelling? But I would say icky. Like, right? Like, bacteria...
Well, let me ask it this way. Do they have a smell, the bacteria?
Yeah, I'm imagining, like, you know, if you've gone a while without brushing your teeth and your breath's all stinky and it's from bacteria that are, like, just going to town on all the little latent things in your mouth that they can eat, and then they're giving off gross odors. So I'm going to go with yes.
And going back to farts, same thing. Bacteria.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're giving off gross odors. The bacteria themselves have no smell. So excellent. Almost a trick question.
Okay.
Good job.
Well, they, like, the outer layer of bacteria typically, right? Well, it depends if they're gram positive or negative, but is like a membrane, like a phospholipid layer that's like fat and stuff. But they still don't smell?
Apparently they do not, based on what I looked up. I was like, do microorganisms have an odor? And the research I found said they don't specifically have odors, but they give off things that do have odors. So I put it as a maybe.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm not
by this definition,
I mean, it's
do
just
humans?
My odors I'm giving off. You're
right.
Not smelling
you.
Me. You're smelling my disgusting odors.
Man, you guys are picking this up way quicker than I expected. Okay. It's like you're smart. Okay, next. Ashley, this one. I think it'll be fun. Do books have a smell?
Oh, I've done a thing on this. They do, because the paper
no fair,
is
she's cheating
giving
by
off
knowing
stuff.
Things.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Paper, the leather bound, if they're, you know, older books, they release all sorts of compounds. According to the International League for Antiquarian Booksellers, awesome. Want to go to
the
their meetings?
The League of Antiquarians. Not an association. Not a club. No, sorry.
The league.
Are you in the league?
Are you a league member?
International league. So it gives off lignin, which is vanilla smelling to us, and it's found in wood-based paper. The glue, the paper, the leather all break down, and they create, quote, grassy notes with a tang of acids and a hint of vanilla over an underlying mustiness. It is, right? Really nice.
Beautiful. No, I don't quote me on this, but I think I want to say that the vanillin we put in our food is from the same thing that the smell of books is.
Oh, instead
from.
Of like the expensive compound. Ass vanilla bean, we just go to.
Yeah. The stuff that we like, the fake stuff.
They're
I think,
just in like libraries, like
thing?
Scraping the pages.
No, that up.
And then bottling. That's how it works,
right,
I'm
exactly.
sure.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
according
how
to a 2016
money.
Article from Scientific American, you're not wrong. They can use the flour, but they can also synthesize vanilla flavor from other things, including lignin. So
very cool.
Awesome. It says 85% is vanillin nice. Synthesized from Bam. A petrochemical, but most of the rest is lignin.
Wow.
Interesting. Okay, two more. Julian.
Yeah.
I know you know something about this, or we'll see if you remember the video that you did about it. Does a clean, chlorinated swimming pool have a smell?
This was a fact that stuck with me forever and ever. No. No. In fact, when you're smelling, when you go into like a pool and you smell like, oh, that's a lot of chlorine. Actually, it's because like the chlorine is reacted with things in the pool and like killed it, and that's what you're smelling. But a well chlorinated, like properly chlorinated, clean swimming pool is odorless.
That's right.
I learned that bleach is the same way. So every time you smell those smells, it's like, oh, this used to be real dirty.
A lot of what we smell like, is stuff that's bonded to human-based things and have flaked into the air. I like to use flaked because it just sounds terrible. Mm. So the chlorine smell is when the chlorine has bonded with like oils and fat lipids and things that were on our skin and they've gone into the air of the natatorium. Okay, last one. Ashley, does glass, like at a restaurant or at your house, when you put your face into it, does it have a smell?
Oh, I'm going to say no. I feel like the thing that I smell when I smell a glass is either the liquid that's in it
exactly.
or the dust.
Glass is
that's
just
in
like
it.
Metal. It has no volatile chemicals that it gives off or no volatile. It's called a VOC, a volatile organic compound. And so if you think that your phone has a smell, which is made of typically metal or glass, that's just you or someone else who's used your phone, which is pretty gross.
Always gross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if dishes smell like anything, it's not the glass, but it's either something that was in the water, the food, the detergent residue. And in fact, pure water also has no smell and no taste. So anything that you, when you drink water or smell water, and it smells like water, you're not actually smelling the water molecules. You're smelling other stuff that was suspended within the water. Okay, so that's it for smell or no smell. Da 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 da. Gross. So Good job, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you. I think we tied. I think we tied 2-2.
Hooray.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't even keeping score.
What,
yeah.
What is the point of the game? You have to keep score. I'm highly competitive.
So what did we learn? That all bloody, metally smells are humans, that all glass smells of humans, that all chlorinated stuff smells of humans. And so what I took away from that is Agent Smith was right, and that the Matrix probably smells really bad to anyone who's not a human.
Mm-hmm. We stink.
But yeah, we smell really terrible. And all of this comes from VOCs. And those VOCs do flake off of things. The thing is, humans are constantly replenishing them. If we didn't, eventually we wouldn't smell because we would either dry out and there would be nothing to flake off because most of the things that are flaking off are organic compounds that are from that have to be carried in the air on humidity, or we would disappear. So things do disintegrate really slowly when they are smelly. And if they're not disintegrating, like metal or glass, they're not smelly. So your question, can something disintegrate from being smelly, is absolutely, because that's the only way we smell anything.
Wow.
Is by it slowly disintegrating.
Wow.
And I did come up with an example that I teased at the beginning of what specifically disappears. A great example is rubbing alcohol or other kind of substances similar. It's highly volatile. So if you poured it onto any surface, it would evaporate into the air, leaving a smell that that alcohol smell that you can sense with no residue at all. So a pure rubbing alcohol, like an isopropyl alcohol, is just going to disappear into the air and completely volatilize, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
An apple or some other like organic thing, a marshmallow, probably not. Because what will end up happening is slowly over time, the bits that would flake off would do that. And everything else, like if you've left a marshmallow out after a while, it just kind of gets smaller and smaller until it becomes this hard little rock. And that thing wouldn't give off any other gases unless you either heated it and added energy to it or rehydrated it or something else where you could have it flake off more and more because it would need to be able to do that.
So that's why spices stop smelling, is because they just get dried out and then they don't.
Exactly. Really have, and so the stuff that was on its surface that would have volatilized, in chemistry is what they call it, would have disappeared. There also are solids that turn into gases and volatilize. It's not like all solids don't. You know, I mentioned earlier, CO2 has no odor, but dry ice is solid carbon dioxide that turns into gas, sublimates immediately. So we can't smell it, but if you just leave dry ice out, it eventually disappears. Mm-hmm. And it's the same concept as this, like, evaporation, if you will, of the isopropyl alcohol.
That's another thing that kind of, I feel like dry ice has a smell, you know, when you have like a concert or something and they use dry ice, but it's, that smell is probably the sensation of like humidity or something.
I did a video a long time ago about the smell of cold. And I think you're right. It just has something to do with like when you think of a freshly fallen snow and you go outside and you smell like winter, that isn't really the snow. It's the stuff that's caught in the snow. It's, you know, bits of trees and dirt and things that have been hydrated. So they're slowly volatilizing into our atmosphere, which is really, smells really nice.
Or famously, the smell of rain, right, nice. Is like a combination of the dust that gets kicked up by the falling raindrops. And then the added humidity also makes your nose more sensitive.
Well, that's also bacteria, though, right? I think it's like bacteria in the soil also, like fart stuff, like create that petrichor.
Mm, everything is farts. Everything you've ever smelled is a fart at some level. So you're just smelling marshmallow farts when I'm in the grocery store. Marshmallow toots.
Love it.
So you can become nose blind, which I think is a good follow-up question to this. A lot of people would be like, okay, but wait, like spices eventually don't smell. Or like you go, I think a great example is you go into a pet store and you open, the doors open or you go in and it's just like, woo, this smells in here. But then a few minutes later, doesn't. And what is essentially happening is your brain is just like, all right, I got it. Yeah, that's like, I hear you receptors, but I'm ignoring you now. Like they're still, it's, you're still smelling it. Physically, your receptors are still getting hit with all those pieces of farts. But your brain is just ignoring it at that point, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. We do this with a lot of stuff too, like touch, you know, like when you first put on clothing, you feel, you know, the shirt on you. And then at a certain point, you just don't think about it anymore. Although now that I've said that, how many of you are thinking like, oh, I'm aware of my shirt again on my skin.
Gross.
Yeah, like could you imagine if you had extreme focus on every single one of your footprints?
No.
Like,
it would be overwhelming.
Every time your foot hit
the
ground.
Where is your foot right now? You know, yeah. Kind of a thing.
Right.
Show it to me. Show me that wiki feet. Let me wiki feet.
So did you ever wonder then, since now you know that these are physical particles that are hitting the receptors that connect directly to your brain, they're in the back of your nose, what happens to them after they're done with being recepted?
No.
So there's this organ that essentially washes the olfactory bulb throughout the day with mucus. So it's just kind of constantly bathing them, they think. But either way, they get washed off the receptors and you swallow them. So when you smell someone's fart, what you're actually doing is physically touching all the fart particles and then swallowing them.
I regret asking this now. It was cool until this very moment.
Why are humans?
We're gross. I like it.
Yeah, we are.
I have one more bonus here as well. When I was growing up, I lived in a very rural place, and we could drive not that long, 20 minutes to the mall, which we do a lot in the winter because, you know, it's warm there. And we go to the scented candle store at the mall, and my friend and I would go, and we'd smell, you know, apple and pine tree. And all of these are like lignin. It's just some synthesized thing. It's probably not bits of apple.
Wait,
it's
something
else.
You lived in Michigan, and you went to a candle store to smell pine tree?
Well, in the winter, you can't really go smell pine tree. You can't smell as much. But I wanted to ask, and I think now that we've gone through all this, you probably will think about the answer a little differently. When you pick up a candle and you pop the top off, where do you put your nose to smell the candle?
Over the wick, right?
Yeah.
Like, so you're supposed to put it in the lid.
In the lid.
So if you think of like, that's where the gas is. That's where all of the volatile chemicals are. So the wax itself, eventually, like if you just left the candle open, wouldn't smell like almost anything because it would do the same thing as a marshmallow left out or anything else. It would dry out. And the energy imparted from the heat is what would volatilize it again. But in the lid is where the volatiles are actually stored. So if you smell the lid of the candle, you're going to get what the candle smells like. And if you smell the surface of the candle, it's going to be similar, but not quite right.
Something to do next after I'm done huffing the marshmallows, I'll stroll over in my neighborhood Target to the candle aisle
and try it out. See if it smells more correct.
Huh.
I'm going to do that.
That almost makes up for knowing that I'm swallowing fart all the time. Not all the time. Well, I hope
in
not
your
all
case,
the time.
You're probably swallowing, let's see, in your house, there's a dog and a cat. So you've got cat dander, dog dander. There's humans. So you've got dust mites and a variety of other like tiny organisms that are going into your sinuses and getting stuck there. And you're sensing those. But your brain's ignoring all of that because you've been there for a long time. And then the Bowen's organ is just washing it up. So you're, you know, just swallowing that. And then, you know, when you cook something, that's going into your nose and you're sensing it, and then you swallow it, so that's kind of nice. And then, somebody goes to the bathroom.
A neighbor down the hall passed away last week, and nobody discovered her until a few days ago in the middle of a heat wave. So this is really horrifying. So I regret this so much.
You know, I think we just go back to the beginning of like, what's the tastiest part of a human?
Right.
And now you know that that's not it.
Now I'm unappetized.
You know that's not it.
Wait, do brains have a smell? They'd have to. Anyway, I'm just thinking about, again, would it be tempting? I don't know.
I don't think so. They're kind of jello-y.
Like fatty, right? Like it's mostly fat.
Yeah, I don't know.
Brains, a lot of lipids in there facilitating the neurons.
If you put a brain in a swimming pool.
Right. If you used your giant hands and feet to put a brain in a swimming pool while your friend
playing,
plays the
tuba. What is it? No, they have to play, is it A flat minor.
Major, yeah.
Yeah, then we could drop the brain in the pool and everyone could smell it.
It'd
be a very interesting funerary.
That's how I want to go.
Set up.
Put it in the will.
Really glad this isn't alive.
Well, I'll be dead, but everybody else will be alive, I hope.
So, can something disintegrate from being smelly? It always does, but having it completely disappear would be very unlikely unless it's a specific liquid or sublimating solid, which you wouldn't be able to smell anyway.
Fascinating.
Wow.
Weird.
Very cool.
And gross.
Very satisfied with this answer. Like, 95% satisfied and then upset about the fart, but still really cool.
Well, thank you to Ashley for joining us on this episode of That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. Ashley, where can people find you if they want to listen to your other podcasts, if they want to find you on whatever social networks? Where can they go?
Yeah, Taboo Science. You can listen exactly where you're listening to this podcast. And also tabooscience.show is the website. I'm also at Smashley Hamer, H-A-M-E-R, on Twitter, on Instagram, on Threads.
Are you on Blue Sky yet?
So, yeah. I'm on Blue Sky. I used it for about a week, and then Threads came out, and now I'm not really using it.
Yeah, I think it's tough because now there's so many. Well, thank you for joining us, and I hope that y'all listened and enjoyed, and you know where you can find me and Julian.
Yeah.
So we don't.
I'm on Threads now. Before, I was trying to avoid pushing social media because it's a toxic hellscape. But you can find me on Threads at Hug It Out. H-U-G-G-E-T-O-U-T. Hug It
Nice.
Out. Yeah.
I'm also on Threads and Blue Sky and Mastodon and everywhere. And the show is mostly on Instagram.
Yeah. So you can toot Trace there. Over there, and he'll have to smell it.
That's right.
On Mastodon.
Do I? Digital tooting.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, everyone. And we will see you in 2 weeks with another episode. That's Absurd, Please Elaborate is produced and hosted by me, Trace Dominguez, and Julian Huguet. Our producer-editor is Kyle Sisk, and the executive producer is also me, Trace Dominguez.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. If you have questions, feel free to submit them to us at social media, or you can find a Notion form in the show notes. And if you leave us a review, we would be so grateful. It helps people find the show. And if you take a screenshot of it, send it to us on social media or email, we'll send you a little sticker of the show logo. Totally unbiased review, doesn't have to be 5 stars, but we'd really appreciate it. It helps us grow the show. Thanks.